This is Pet Life Radio. Let's talk pets.
Hello and welcome to Working Like Dogs on Pet Life Radio. Thank you for joining us. I'm your host, Marcy Davis. And with me, as always, is my amazing service dog and co-host, Fenway. And we're so excited to be with you today because today we're heading to one of the most breathtaking places on Earth, Denali National Park and Preserve in Alaska. And we're going to meet some of the hardest working dog teams in the entire federal government. Our guest is David Tomeo, and he's the kennels manager at Denali. And David oversees the only sled dog kennel in the National Park Service, which is a program that's been running continuously since 1922. And these dogs don't just work, they patrol millions of acres of designated wilderness. They haul gear, they haul scientists into remote terrain that no snowmobile is allowed to touch. And they carry forward a cultural tradition that stretches back thousands of years across Alaska. So we're talking about working dogs in the truest, most elemental sense. So come right back after these quick messages as we welcome David Tomeo to the show.
Hey everyone, Brandon McMillan here, CBS host of Lucky Dog Reunions and Lucky Dog Down Under, and spokesperson for the 18th annual Cross Country Pet Adoption Tour, Get Your Licks on Route 66. Brought to you by Fido Friendly Magazine and campaign partner Tranquil Tales, along with media sponsor Pet Life Radio. The tour travels down America's favorite highway, supporting shelter events across America. With support of Tito's Vodka for Dog People, Hands On Gloves, My Place Hotels, KOA, and Signs to You. Attendees at each shelter event can donate to spin and win prizes from our sponsors, with all proceeds benefiting the shelter at the end of the day. Go to FidoFriendly.com to see where the tour stops near you. And who knows, you might just find your new forever friend.
Let's Talk Pets on PetLifeRadio.com.
From Denali National Park. Hello, David, and welcome.
Hello. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, we're so thrilled that you can be with us today, and we want to hear all about it. But first, tell us, what originally drew you to Denali Park, and what was it like to take on the role of kennels manager?
What drew me to Denali was actually sled dogs and running sled dogs. I came here first to mush dogs in Alaska before I even considered working at the national park. I was running dogs in northern Minnesota, had gotten into sled dogs there, and was working with the school, running sled dogs in the Boundary Waters Wilderness area, and just knew that anyone that wants to learn the most they can about dog sledding, they're going to come to Mecca, which is Alaska. And
right.
And like a lot of folks, migrated up here to work with a kennel outside the park, where I was helping them train their sled dogs for the Yukon Quest sled dog race, a 1,000-mile race at that time was running between Fairbanks, Alaska, and Yukon, Whitehorse. So I spent the winter doing that and just fell in love with the area and just couldn't leave. Even though I had a job to go back to in Minnesota, we ended up not going back. We stayed in Alaska. That was back in the mid 90s. And I've been up here ever since.
Wow. Well, when you know you're home, you're home. Yep. That's wonderful. Oh my goodness. Well, when did you actually start working with sled dogs, and how did that happen? Because you must have been really young.
I'm older than I look, maybe.
No.
But I started running sled dogs in northern Minnesota. It was the Outward Bound school there, the Voyager Outward Bound school. I got a job as an intern working the summers and got to walk through the back of the school there and, oh, they have a sled dog kennel and meet the sled dogs. And I just fell in love with the sled dogs there at their school. And within a year or so, I was working winters with that school. And so I spent almost 5 years in Ely, Minnesota, running sled dogs there, and got to work with some amazing people. And we were guiding trips with students into the Boundary Waters Wilderness area by sled dogs. And that was very similar style of travel that we do here in Denali, which is kind of unique in traveling in the wilderness where there are groomed trails. But we were taking students out and oftentimes having maybe 7 to 9 students and heading out into the Boundary Waters Wilderness area with a dog team towing our supplies and most everyone on skis. And it was quite the formative experience for me.
Wow.
To be working with a unique program like that. And there were very special dogs there at that school.
Oh, that sounds like one of those experiences where it's almost like you need to pay them instead of them paying you, because it sounds so much fun and wonderful, but you got paid. That's awesome.
Well, it was the mid-90s. I was an intern, and we can almost say I was paying them.
Well, but then you got your job of kennels manager. And I'm curious, what did you have to learn and demonstrate to get that position?
Yeah, so I've been here as the kennel manager for the last 6 years. And prior to that, I was the education director with a park partner running the Science and Learning Center here in Denali National Park. So 18 years I was working inside the park, running the Science and Learning Center operation. Knew the park really well, but since I had come to Alaska for dog sledding, I have explored a lot of the area by dog team and worked with a lot of the mushers in the local area, that it was a natural transition. And it was COVID time. I jumped from my nonprofit organization over to the running the kennels here when there was this vacancy. And it was a dream job always. And I was lucky enough to be in the right place at the right time and the right skills to jump into this position. And it's been just amazing.
It sounds like it, David. Oh, that sounds wonderful. Denali is on my bucket list. That's for sure.
You should definitely come visit.
Yes, I want to. Yeah, well, tell us about the Denali sled dogs.
Yeah, so this kennel, as you mentioned in your introduction, that we've been in operation here with dogs since 1922. So it's one of the oldest continuous kennels in the country. And it was established to help create the park boundary and patrol into this new park. It had just become a park in 1917. And when the kennels was established, it was a way for the rangers to get out and establish the park boundary. And also the reason the park was created was to preserve the Dall sheep and the wildlife in this, what was seen as a game preserve in the area. And so the dog teams were used to be out and patrolling and letting the gold miners and the folks in the area know that this is now a protected lands and to put an end to the harvesting of Dall sheep inside the park boundary. And that is no longer an issue of poaching of wildlife inside the park. But we still have the dogs, and we use the dogs now for various purposes here. The reason that we still have the dogs is a question that we build into most of our education programs here during the summer, and that is sharing with folks that why we still have dogs, and that is that this area here, as you mentioned, is a wilderness area. We don't allow snow machining or snowmobiling in the park boundary inside the wilderness area. And so we use the dogs to access the park in the wintertime. Some of these areas where we need to go or park scientists need to get to are easier to get to in the wintertime, that rather than going through marshy swamp and or brushy areas in the in the summer months. In the wintertime, if we get good snowpack, we just float right on top of the dogs and cruise into the park. So we use the dogs for helping park scientists get to their study sites. We'll often be trained in and gathering data for park scientists. So we'll be doing some, like this coming winter, we'll be doing some snow surveys out there in the park for various studies. The past couple of winters, some of our projects include helping some permafrost scientists get to their study sites. We also mushed out and repaired a camera that was watching a landslide underneath the new bridge that's being built in the park that needed repairing. We hauled all types of material in and out. So whether it be boardwalks for a trail building project, or this winter, we hauled some mattresses into the patrol cabins and hauled some old kind of rodent chewed up mattresses out of the old patrol cabins. So there's various projects like that that we're working on throughout the winter, as well as just putting in trails for visitors to make use of. Because without the snow machines, without the trail grooming, it's challenging to get out there. And so our dogs, they're good at breaking trail. They'll be out front. And when it gets too deep for them, I might have to put on skis or snowshoes and be out in front of the dogs. But getting those trails in allows visitors access into the park and helps them get out there. And then the other reason you also mentioned that we still have the dogs is we're carrying on that cultural tradition of educating people about dog sledding in the North Country, that for hundreds and hundreds of years, there were dog teams in every village in Alaska. And that is becoming more and more rare to find dog teams. So us having a dog team that we're showing the public, we're demonstrating in front of them what we do with them, and we're helping to carry on that tradition, teach them about these traditional knowledge of running dogs and using dogs and carrying on what is a 10,000-year-old tradition.
Oh, I love it. That is so beautiful. And you guys just seem like the heartbeat of the park. If you're doing all of those different types of services to your employees, your staff, to external people like the scientists, I mean, that is so incredible and rewarding. And I can't imagine, as you were describing that, I was just imagining gliding over that gorgeous snow, fresh powder with those incredible sled dogs. Wow, that must be like an out-of-body experience. That sounds, I want to intern with you, David. That sounds really good. Yeah, well, so I read where you said that you described the Denali sled dogs as more like football linebackers than marathon runners compared to the Iditarod racing dogs. So tell us, what are you thinking about that distinction and what it means for how you breed and train these dogs?
So, of course, we are breeding and raising and using Alaskan Huskies. And Alaskan Huskies is not a kennel club registered breed. It's a dog that's mixed of many northern breeds, and it's really a dog made for being a top athlete for the job that we're asking them to do. And that is one of the reasons that different kennels have different types of dogs. So if you're going to run the Iditarod, which is a 1,000-mile race, you need a dog with a lot of endurance that can do long, long miles every single day and has very durable feet and can really put down the calories to maintain running 100 miles a day versus our kennel, where we want a lot of those attributes, but we also need dogs that are a bit bigger, that longer legged, they have bigger chests, that they can break through deeper snow, where the racing dogs, they will typically have groomed trails or at least broken open trails. So their goal is to maintain a high speed, where we don't care so much about the speed we're going at, but we do need dogs that are tough enough to get through some of the deep snow, go through deep overflow, which is water and slush on top of ice. And then also we're with the traveling that we're doing, we're not traveling 100 miles a day. A big day for us might be 30 miles.
Wow, that's a lot.
And we when we get to our camps, or whether it be we're camping out or we're staying in a patrol cabin, we park the dogs all around the cabin, and they camp out and they sleep outside. So we need dogs that are have good thick coats, big thick tails that can cover up their nose, keep their face warm when it's cold out there. And so the racing dogs, whether Iditarod or sprint racing, they actually prefer dogs that don't have as thick a coat as our dogs, because they're running so much, they need to shed heat. We're not running fast enough that we need to shed a lot of heat. So our dogs, yeah, they're bigger, longer legged, bigger chested, thicker coats. We tend to have dogs that are the females are around 60 pounds, the males are up to 100 pounds. So big, big dogs. And so another comparison that people give with the Alaskan Huskies you'll encounter when you come through Alaska is you go to one kennel and they're sprint dogs. They're running really fast. They might be doing 25, 30 miles an hour on these shorter race runs. And then you could go to Iditarod kennel and they're a little bit bigger. And then you come to our kennel and they look like giants. But the comparison that we often hear people talk about is, well, there's the sports cars and those are the racing dogs. And then we're more of the Mack trucks, the big freight hauling dogs.
Yeah, that always come up and got your back. Yeah, I love it. I love it. Well, we've got a whole lot more questions for David about these incredible working dogs, but we're going to take just a quick break and hear some important messages from our sponsors, but it'll be fast. So come right back.
Talk to the Paw.
Hi, this is Amy Stewart.
Hi, I'm Jane Lynch.
This is Mandy Bourne.
Hi there, I'm Kate Walsh.
This is Catherine Tygo.
There's only one station that gives you the scoop on wagging tongues and tails and who's walking who in Rent and Tinseltown. Pet Life Radio, the tail wagger.
Let's talk pets.
Let's talk pets.
On Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
Tomio from Denali National Park. He serves as the kennels manager. And before the break, he was telling us all about these incredible sled dogs that he works with every day. And you were talking about the difference and what an Alaskan Husky is and about the mixed breeding. And that's so interesting, and that they're not registered with any kennel club that you mentioned. So I also read, David, that you use genetic testing for your dogs. Can you tell us about that work and practice?
Yeah. So people often ask here about the breeding program that we run here. And so like most dog mushers, we evaluate their dogs based on our observations and their performance. And so it's how well did they run? How intelligent are they? Most dogs that get chosen for breeding are the lead dogs. They tend to be the smartest, the most confident. They take commands. And there's all of that sort of performative behaviors that we are looking for. And so I have a team of mushers that work with me, and we compare notes every day. We're chatting about, oh, well, Boomer did this, and Royal was really showing some progress in this. And so we're evaluating, and we do end up rating their performance in helping us make decisions about breeding. But that's only what we can see. And this is where genetic testing nowadays has just greatly improved breeding for all dog owners, especially all kennels that are producing service dogs, that the genetic tests, and we use the one that originated out of Cornell University, the Embark. There are many, a couple different varieties, but the ones that we'll do swabs and send them in. And the genetic reports that we get on these dogs are just incredible, because not only do you get some of the genealogy or the origin of the various types of breeds that are within our Alaskan Huskies, but we get these health reports that are just incredible. And really give us the information, some key information of dogs that we, things that we might not be able to, well, we know we can't see, but that would keep maybe remove a dog from the breeding list. So there's a number of genetic ailments that are common in sled dogs, like encephalitis and various things that if all dog kennels are using it, we can really push some of these diseases out of the breeding pool completely. And that would be wonderful if we can get to that level. And so we'll use those health reports to kind of screen out dogs. And then we also use the genetic tests for, we can have a dog from another kennel if it has a genetic report on it. There's now tools where we can put their two genetic reports together, and using AI, they can produce a report of here's the likely outcome of puppies from this breeding. So we can do these hypothetical breedings using their genetic data and get a report on what we're likely to see. So there are some things that are recessive genes that maybe we don't like, but breed them with other dogs that don't carry them, then it even lowers the probability for the young. But we can get reports that will even just give us some appearance likelihood of coloration and eyes in those pups long before we consider breeding. So that's been just an amazing tool for us to produce healthier dogs. So with my team, we look at performance, which is always going to be the most valuable. We don't want to breed a dog that looks good genetically but doesn't perform well. Mm-hmm. But we do want to make sure we are breeding the healthiest dog and that our genetic makeup is such that we are not working towards inbreeding as well. So the coefficient of inbreeding is probably one of the more prominent things we always look at. And I would say like Alaskan Huskies, good kennels, we can keep our inbreeding levels extremely low. So for us, maybe an average inbreeding number or percentage of the parents that match the genes that match is about to maybe 4 or 5%, where let's say a pug or some of these very highly bred dogs, their coefficient of inbreeding might be 45-50% of matching genes between the parents, which is quite inbred. So we end up with healthier dogs. And I think that's why Alaskan Huskies, they don't have the ailments. They don't have the old age issues that you see in a lot of the purebreds.
That's
but
incredible.
With genetic testing, it's all dogs should be healthier now if everyone's using it as the great tool it is.
Yeah, I know in the service dog industry, they definitely are getting much better at that. And it's just like you said, they're getting dogs that are healthier, that can work longer, and they can plan more because they know more of what they're going to be getting. But that is such valuable information for your population. Yeah, that's great. Well, you've spoken about the cultural significance of mushing as a traditional mode of travel in Alaska, going back 15,000 years or probably longer. How do you hold that history consciously in the work that you do with the dogs every day?
Oh, good question. So one of the things I like to tell people is that when I hook up a dog team, I bring dogs down the gang line, and then I untie my sled and we rocket off down the trail, that I am traveling in the same manner that someone did 100 years ago or even 10,000 years ago. And other than me just, I might have a sat phone in my pocket and I might be wearing synthetic clothes. Like everything is so similar to the way it was years and years and years ago. So it is like traveling back in time. That, and especially when we leave park headquarters, within about 20 minutes, we're out of cell phone range, and then we get out and stay at our patrol cabins. There's no Wi-Fi, there's no nothing. And we live in these rustic cabins when we're out on patrol or even camping. So there is this just amazing feeling that we could be in the 1800s, we could be thousands of years ago in the way we travel. So that's pretty special, just pretty amazing.
What a connection. Yeah, connection to the land, to the past, to the canines. I mean, there's not a whole lot of people that can say that, David. I see why you went and stayed. Yeah, that's a pretty unique, special place on the planet.
Yeah, the evidence right now is that the earliest evidence we have of dog sledding is about 10,000 years ago. It's evidence an archaeological site in northern Russia, off in the Arctic Ocean on an island, Zhukov Island, evidence of dog sleds and dog skeletons and distinct dog breeds, some of the earliest evidence of dogs pulling sleds. And then, of course, dogs have been working with humans for 30,000 years.
Yes.
As they became domesticated.
And yes, in so many ways. Well, you also mentioned about the work that you and the dogs do as scientists. Tell us, how does that scientific partnership evolve? How do people get those opportunities?
Yeah, so here in Denali National Park, we do have a pretty large science team that works at studying this landscape. We are a science-based park. And then we also have a number of universities that have studies that they'll work alongside with the Park Service, get research permits and working with the park staff to help us better understand this landscape. Because Denali is the entire park is 5 million acres, and it's a pretty unique, undisturbed area for us to learn about this landscape, but whether it be the wildlife or the vegetation, and even looking at the impacts that the climate and changes on the climate might have on a landscape like ours here. So yeah, the park scientists here at the park will often reach out to us and about helping with projects. So I just put a reminder out in our staff newsletter about, hey, check back with us about if you got projects lined up for this winter or you need access into the park. So I know that our fire crew is going to be doing some work on the remote north side, and they may seek some assistance for us or getting them in there to help take out some vegetation around the patrol cabins for firewise protection. And then the permafrost scientists, I believe, are going to be back again continuing their study of permafrost along the park road, which is critical for the road infrastructure, is we're wanting to know what's happening with the permafrost along the road. As that changes, suddenly roads can collapse or slide down hills. So we'll work with them in either gathering data with for them or even towing them out to their study sites with dogs or hauling supplies for them.
That's wonderful. I mean, you're touching on so many different things that impact the planet and all of us that live on it. It's so inspiring. It's wonderful.
Yeah. And to have the dogs, this 10,000-year-old tradition.
Yes.
Towing scientists that have
all the technology at their fingertips. Yeah.
A ground penetrating radar on the sled with us. It's pretty neat. Juxtaposition of
exactly to see that. Yeah But that's so wonderful, though, of bringing those two things together, something that seems so maybe old or old-fashioned, and then with the latest technology and how they support each other, and each one needs each other. Yeah, that's what's so lovely about it. Well, tell us, as you are having puppies and breeding puppies, how many litters do you usually have a year? How many total dogs? And then tell us about how many puppies.
We try to have about 30 adult dogs and then puppies as well for running the kennel operation. Right now, we're a little bit low. We have 26 adult dogs and 4 puppies out there in the yard. And we do retire our dogs a little bit earlier than other kennels, because they put in hard work here, and and we want them to go into retirement to their adoptive families that they go and join, become a pet dog. We want them to have a number of years with their families as well. So we retire them at age 9. So because of that, we are looking to always be adding more dogs. So we try to aim for 1 litter a year. And going back to health and genetics, we do try to partner with other kennels around the state here, and sometimes even out of state, for our breeding. So it's pretty typical, like what happened this year, where we worked with a kennel north of Fairbanks. They had a great male that we wanted to breed with. We had the female. We sent her up there for the breeding process, and then she gave birth here, and then we ended up splitting the litter with that kennel. So that's pretty common for us, and it works out great for both kennels, that we both benefit from that crossing of different lines of genetics as well.
Well, I love that you retire them early. That was my next question for you, David, was about our listeners are always wanting to know what happens to dogs after they retire from their career job. Is there an adoption process, or how does that retirement work for them?
Yes, we have on our website at the Denali National Park website, we have a page dedicated to our adoption program, and there's a form you can fill out and apply to adopt a dog. We do say right up front, because these are Alaskan Huskies, northern breeds, so we really need them to go to northern climates. So we unfortunately won't be sending them down to Arizona or Florida. But we have people apply to adopt them. So we get people from all over the country that do that. And then we go through a review process of each dog. Every dog is different. Their personality is different. Their needs are different. So some dogs would be great jumping into a home that had one or two other dogs. Some dogs would really be best if they went to a home with no other dogs. Some dogs are good with kids, and some dogs are nervous around kids. So we go through that. But when we do make a choice, we do a ceremony here. So every day during the summer, we have three demonstrations for the public. So we'll have 200 to 400 people here three times a day for a demonstration. And when we do have a retirement, we'll often tag on a short retirement ceremony in front of this large crowd. We'll have the dog run one more lap around with its teammates and come up into the area there where the presentation's happening. And then we say, we have a special announcement where so-and-so is going to be retiring now. And it's a very, very touching moment.
Yes, extremely.
We say, just recently we retired a couple dogs, and I shared, well, so-and-so has done 12,000 miles of patrols with us here in the park, dedicated their life to this. They were born here. And now they're going to become a pet dog with a family and get to enjoy a spoiled life of treats and couches and being indoors. And a 9-year-old husky is such a great pet, because they have, as young huskies are very wild. They're not the easiest dogs to raise in a house. They'll destroy a lot of furniture. They just have energy. They love to run. But by 9, they know what's comfortable, and they love.
Yes, they want the good life. Then, like all of us at retirement. Yes, yes. Oh, and they deserve it.
Yeah, a lot of our dogs will. They'll all go live with a family, but many of them, because they were official canine rangers here with the National Park Service, the families that they go live with, we've had many of them have gone to do school assemblies, and they bring their dog in, or they go and visit assisted living homes, or just continue on the outreach effort of sharing this tradition with people. And other dogs have gone on to become therapy dogs with their families. So they continue to be ambassadors for this program.
Oh, well, David, I could sit and listen to you talk all day about these little amazing canines. And I love the title, Canine Ranger. I love that. That's such a great job title for them. But thank you so much for the work that you're doing. And please, please come back and be with us again and tell us more about your work. It really is very unique, the situation that you're in with the environment and with these amazing working dogs. So thank you. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And thank you for having me.
My pleasure. And thank you, our listeners, for being with us. We are so glad you are here today, and we love to hear from you. So please keep those emails coming. And you know, you can reach me at Marcie, M-A-R-C-I-E, at PetLifeRadio.com, and we'll be sure to put the web link so that you can check out the Denali Sled Dog Kennels on our website at Pet Life Radio, Working Like Dogs. So thanks so much. We love hearing from you, and take good care.
Let's Talk Pets, every week on demand, only on PetLifeRadio.com.